Hello, I'm Lori Watanabe, the editor of Mobility Management Magazine and your host for this Mobility Management podcast. Today, I'm welcoming Justin Richardson, who is the Director of Advocacy Strategy for New Motion. Justin Richardson has used a manual wheelchair for 17 years and is a 13-year veteran of the seating and mobility industry. He has a deep perspective and experience as a former ATP, operations manager, communications, and customer experience leader. Currently, Justin also serves as the executive director of the New Motion Foundation and sits on the board of the North Carolina Spinal Cord Injury Association. Justin, welcome to the podcast and thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Lori. I'm excited to be here.
The idea for teaming up with you for a podcast originally came from a conversation with McKay Lee at NCART about why she thought self-advocacy can be really challenging for some people who have disabilities. And so McKay said you would be someone great to talk to. And I'm a big fan of yours. I'm a huge fan of your social media posts. And of course, we've worked together a little bit in your New Motion capacity and as the executive director of the New Motion Foundation. When I invite someone to join the podcast, I usually have a very specific topic for us to talk about. But Justin, in this case, I just have a lot of different questions on a lot of subjects. So thanks very much for just kind of agreeing to have a conversation with me. So I'd like to start with a current events question. Because of your work in the New Motion Foundation, you interact daily with people who have disabilities, and obviously you, as a member of the New Motion team, work constantly with people in that community. How did 2020 impact the community of people who live with disabilities?
Yes, so I think first and foremost, you know, people with disabilities were affected in many of the same ways that people without disabilities were affected. You know, even as we record this, so there's plenty of hope in our future, and obviously vaccinations, they've begun to roll out. We're still at the peak of this pandemic. And I think it's scary for us all. So I do want to begin by acknowledging everyone's struggle here, including those in the disability community, but those in the community who are also living without a disability. And it's important for me to say that for a lot of reasons, but really because of the fact that I watched so many of our team members at Motion, you know, many of which, again, who are living without disability, wake up every day and seriously work so hard to meet the needs of my community. And I'm incredibly grateful for their work, you know, whether they be the ATPs or the seating specialists or service technicians or their support staff. And of course, you know, our clinical partners who have continued to serve our community in the past year. But specific to the disability community, you know, by definition, we all have pre-existing conditions, which of course puts most of us at higher risk for the negative effects of COVID-19. And I think that knowledge has made, you know, the fear of contracting COVID that much more terrifying for all of us. And that's especially true for those of us in our community with additional complications beyond our primary diagnoses. You know, one thing I've heard a lot about from almost all of our national partners and many of the smaller nonprofit organizations serving our community has been the concern over mental health. And let's face it, you know, disability is often isolating when there's no pandemic raging outside of our doors. And quarantine has only kind of increased the isolation that many of us are struggling with. And many others are struggling with caretaker inconsistency as those who, you know, they rely upon to meet their daily needs are facing their own uncertainty. You know, and I think there's some things in the media that we've all heard, you know, fears about rationing of care in certain markets where, you know, there's high impact areas where life or death decisions or, you know, the decision to treat someone or not treat someone, you know, in regard to COVID is maybe based on a perceived quality of life. You know, who's making those decisions and why is someone else's perception of what my quality of life is, you know, going to be the determining factor over whether or not I receive care in a high impact area. So, it is scary. And I can personally speak about the fact that, you know, a box of latex gloves that, you know, I may use, you know, on a daily basis, they were $7 before the pandemic started. And you get $7 for 100 gloves. And now if you can find a single box, it's, you know, they're $25 or more. So I could go on and on. But, I think in summary, many in the disability community are facing all the same things that those without disabilities are facing, fear and stress and anxiety and financial uncertainty, childcare concerns, attempting to work and somehow be a part-time teacher to our children. You know, all of those things, and then amplify them by the power of disability, where so many are forced to rely on mobility equipment or others just to meet our basic needs. And unfortunately, when the system breaks down, it's a chain reaction, and our community, they often feel the pain first. So, you know, sadly, we're also sometimes forgotten when mainstream assistance is considered, and some people were left behind, you know, in the bailouts that recently were passed by Congress, for example. But, you know, I will say one thing. Some things about this past year have been amazing for many of us in the disability community. I know it sounds trivial, but, curbside pickup at restaurants and grocery stores and retail has been an incredible advancement, something that I hope continues long into the future. The adoption of telehealth has also been particularly important for those of us with disabilities, and there are efforts underway now to ensure telehealth's availability long after the conclusion of this pandemic. So there have been a lot of negative effects, but there have been, you know, several things that have been positive advancements and changed the way that people do business, which have been beneficial to our community.
Well, that's a great segue to my next question, I think, which is about the assistive technology, about the changes that people who have mobility-related disabilities truly want and changes that they would truly find helpful. For instance, I've seen a lot of stair-climbing wheelchairs over the years in this industry. And the last time I saw a photo of a stair-climbing wheelchair prototype, it was attached to a tweet from a woman who uses a wheelchair. And her comment was, "For goodness sake, we just want ramps." And I think a lot of people who aren't disabled have the wrong ideas of what people with disabilities actually prioritize and what would actually be helpful to them. For example, I think a lot of people assume that people who use wheelchairs want to walk and that walking or standing is their fondest, most important wish. But I've seen a lot of responses from wheelchair users that indicate that that isn't true at all. So my question to you is, what do you think people with disabilities really want, and what sorts of assistive technology or accessibility improvements would be the most helpful day to day?
Yeah, I think this is a tricky question, and I want to preface this by saying that one thing I love about our community is that we all come from, you know, very different walks of life, and we are as diverse as the rest of our population. So I don't want to claim to speak for everyone living with a disability. But, you know, that said, I think for many of us, we just want access to the equipment and accessibility options needed to allow us to just be a part of society. You know, we want to go to work, go to school. We want to date. We want to go out with our friends. You know, everything else that everyone else wants out of life. You know, would it be cool to be able to climb stairs? I mean, yeah, that would be pretty cool if it was functional and I could do so relatively quickly and in a way that would not, you know, quote unquote, cause a scene, but that's far from my primary concern in regard to mobility. You know, do I want an ultra lightweight wheelchair? Absolutely. Of course I do. And we've all seen the research that shows the benefits of lightweight manual chairs for those of us who use them. But, you know, I also don't want to trade a few ounces of weight for parts that break 2 months into the life of my chair. You know, I'm not a power chair user, but we can all acknowledge the fact that many who do utilize power chairs have more severe advanced disabilities than those who don't. And with that in mind, many who use power chairs want more than just a joystick that gets them from point A to point B. They want a command system that allows them full access to their environment. You know, the sad thing is the technology is out there. We just have to figure out a way to remove the barriers to this technology and find better ways to integrate these advancements into our mobility equipment. And our healthcare reimbursement system, you know, look, let's be honest, it doesn't make it easy, but we're making progress on important features such as standing and seat elevation. And these changes are happening, even if they are happening slower than many of us would like. But I think in summary, at the end of the day, we just want solid, reliable equipment that primarily helps us meet our basic needs, our activities of daily living, and also allows us to be part of our communities, whether they be in person or online.
Okay, and then I'll use that to sort of jump off to my next question, which is sort of related to what you've just said. Before you transition to your current position at NewMotion, I know you worked as an ATP. And I wanted to know what you think seating and mobility clients wish their seating team knew. Because I know it's so common for everyone to experience sort of a white coat syndrome, which is when you talk to doctors or other clinicians, you can kind of feel intimidated or embarrassed, hesitant to bring up some questions that you have. Maybe you feel that the doctor is rushed and so you don't want to share everything, or you are embarrassed that you don't already know the answer, that you haven't brought it up in the past. So we don't say things. We don't communicate maybe as well as we could or we want to. What do you think clients wish that their seating and wheeled mobility team knew about them or knew about the challenges that they face?
Yeah, and again, I'm gonna preface this by saying how much we love our clinical partners and the mobility professionals that serve our community, and I work with a ton of incredible mobility professionals every day of the week. But you know what I'm about to say is maybe a little bit controversial. Sometimes we just don't care about what the best thing for us may be clinically. If that recommendation or new piece of equipment or change to our existing equipment is going to negatively alter our ability to perform a necessary task or just something we enjoy doing, in even the smallest way. You know, for example, if a new backrest makes my posture better but impedes my ability to reach back behind me, chances are pretty high that I'm not going to use that backrest. If a seat width change would provide better stability, but it would make it more difficult to independently transfer, there is no amount of stability that's worth the transition from, you know, being independent to being dependent. If a new seat cushion provides, you know, slightly better relief, you know, pressure relief, but doubles or triples the weight of our previous cushions, you know, chances are solid that we won't be using that cushion. And I think most of us are aware that everything is a trade-off in the mobility space. You know, every change we make to our chair, there's a positive and a negative aspect of each when it comes to mobility. And I also want to acknowledge the fact that in all circumstances, I think it's incredibly important to make the most clinically sound decision possible when it comes to our equipment. I think we would all agree with that. And our clinicians and our mobility professionals, they're the experts. And we look to them for guidance and fully respect their knowledge and their training and their expertise. But with that said, like, we're the ones who will be living with the results of these decisions. And not only do we want to be, but many of us expect to be active participants in the mobility process. And, you know, a single clinician or mobility professional's assumption without fully involving the customer in the decision-making process could be the reason for lack of compliance with recommendations or other negative outcomes. You know, I get it. I served as an ATP for 7 years. I've been in the clinics and I've been in those evaluations, and you might have a lot of people to see. And time is short, and there's a ton to cover in that brief period of time. But my singular piece of advice to all involved in this process would be to make sure that the customer is as involved in the decision-making process as is possible. Now, he or she may not understand every clinical or technical decision being made, but they are the ones that are the subject matter experts in their own needs.
And it sounds really important as well that if you are the ATP or you're the clinician and you're saying something like, we love the stability that this new seat width, this adjusted seat width is going to provide you, that you really look at the other side of the coin then. You try to give them room to be honest with you, I guess, and say, well, but it really makes my transferring harder though. And I don't know that I can do this by myself, so that you can maybe get that conversation going. And it's not just a one-way communication from the seating team that this is what we're going to do because this is what is clinically best. You're saying that it would be so much better if this could be a conversation with room for everybody to sort of share their own story.
Yeah, I think not only is it better, but it has to be. I mean, that has to be how this process, you know, occurs moving forward. My last chair, I was an ATP, like I said, for many years. But my last chair, the chair I'm in right now that I received, you know, over the summer, I went over that spec sheet probably 10 times before I approved it and sent it off. And I'm someone who used to do this every day of the week, you know, as how I made my living. So, yeah, I think the customer has to be involved in this process as much as they're comfortable. And the other part of this, too, is when you're in an evaluation, you know, if you slow down and listen to what the customer has to say and what they're thinking, then information is going to be volunteered throughout the course of that discussion that helps make decisions about how to spec out that chair and how best to position them for success moving forward. So absolutely, I think it's incredibly important that the customer be as involved as possible in the conversation. Some may want to be completely hands-off, but I think those who have a desire to be a part of the process should be given every opportunity to do so.
Okay, perfect. And I wanted to get to the original question that resulted in this idea for podcasting in the first place, and that's about consumer advocacy. We know as an industry that consumers can be so powerful when they share their stories with policymakers, elected officials, staff, etc. But we also know that it's not always easy for them to advocate on their own behalf. And I wanted to ask you what you think causes those challenges or that reluctance. Is it that they fear that they're not going to be respected, they're not going to be heard? Is it largely logistical? Because traveling with a wheelchair, we know, especially with a power chair on an airplane, for example, can be so difficult and so challenging. So what is holding consumers back from what you've seen? And what, as an industry, can we do to make advocacy easier for our consumers because we know their voices are so effective?
Yeah, it's really funny you asked that question. One of the things I enjoy most about my role as Director of Advocacy at New Motion is I do an interview series. I've been doing it for a couple of years now called 14 Questions. And I interview influential members of the advocacy or disability community. I bring that up, as, you know, in part as a shameless plug, but also because of the fact that I often ask this exact same question to everyone I interview. And this is one of the only questions that pops up in almost every single interview. I think for most people, the idea of government and policy and politics is just an incredibly intimidating thing to think about. you know, policy discussions, they seem so complex and daunting and convoluted that I think many in our community simply just don't feel educated enough on any particular topic to even consider being an advocate on their own behalf. And honestly, the issues facing our community are often unnecessarily complex. But, you know, the good news is you don't have to know every single thing about every single issue to be an advocate. You know, the numbers that are out there that back up our arguments, they don't lie. But you don't have to be an accountant to be an advocate. There are plenty of bean counters in government whose numbers can easily back up or refute any claims that we make in a meeting or a phone call or an email. You know, I personally think that an advocate's greatest strengths, they're just twofold. It's their presence and their story. And I think presence is important because it says to the person or group that you're meeting with that whatever you're there to discuss is important enough to you that you cared enough to show up or to write or to call. And then, of course, your story, it's important because it puts a human face on the previously mentioned numbers on paper. Those numbers that don't lie, well, when you show up, write, or call, they now have a name and a face and a voice. And one thing I've learned over the course of, you know, my career is that it's much easier to ignore ink on paper than it is someone in front of you or has reached out to you personally. And that's true whether that interaction is in person or over the phone or in their inbox. And you know, another thing I share with advocates is that the person you're speaking to probably knows less about the topic of the hour than you do. It's your job to introduce the topic, you know, provide a few eye-catching facts, explain the reason why you feel change is important, and tie all of that back to your own story or the stories of those you represent. You don't have to know it all. You just have to know enough. And often enough is mostly your story, and no one but you is the subject matter expert on your story. Yeah, as for the logistical challenges, in-person advocacy is incredibly empowering and often the most effective form of advocacy. But there are so many ways to be an advocate these days without traveling to D.C. or state capitol building. You know, signing up for advocacy alerts from groups like NCARD or your consumer representation group or other organizations like NewMotion are easy ways to learn about and participate in advocacy opportunities. You know, these opportunities are often as easy as filling in your address in a pre-formatted letter, but even this type of advocacy still has a tremendous impact. You know, as for what we can do as an industry to make advocacy easier for consumers, I think we need to do a better job of making complex issues appear less complex while also removing any perceived barriers to advocacy that may exist. And I say perceived because I truly believe there are few barriers to advocacy. You know, if you are able to communicate in any way, you are capable of advocacy. And for an advocate, you know, the first step here is to express interest. Next step is to take action. And I found that, you know, acknowledging and expressing interest is often the most difficult of those two steps. I think for me personally, you know, the biggest challenge is the fact that I have over time developed my own rather strong political views, which I'm sure you're aware of by seeing my social media feeds. But, you know, I have to remind myself that we need legislators on both sides of the aisle in order to advance the agenda, you know, of people with disabilities. And sometimes I do a better job of that than others, keeping those views to myself. And, you know, to be frank, some situations arise when I make the determination that the juice is worth the squeeze here, that, you know, an issue is so important to me that I may speak out or, you know, in a way that I'm well aware may make representatives of one party or the other displeased with what I have to say, and that any critical comments would, you know, may one day rise up and haunt me in a meeting on the Hill. You know, when those situations arise, it's always a calculated decision. And I believe that's a result of the fact that those of us involved in advocacy are involved because we care and care deeply about the issues that brought us to advocacy in the first place. And, you know, it's a tightrope. All of us must walk. There are added complexities involved when the issues you're addressing affect you both professionally and personally, as they do for me. As an industry, I feel like we need to do a better job of placing advocacy opportunities front and center, you know, educating and empowering those we serve. It all goes back to being an active participant in mobility. You know, this goes back to the same thing we talked about with evaluations and the chair selection process. Our industry, we can't do it alone. We seriously need the voices of the customer in order to affect change. And as a whole, our industry, we just need to do a better job of recruiting customer and end-user advocates. That's definitely step one. And then step two here is educating those advocates in regard to the issues at hand and building their confidence through advocacy experiences. You know, one thing I love is that once you're an advocate, you know, it's in your blood and becomes a part of who you are. It truly is empowering. And many first-time advocates, they eventually become advocates for life.
Well, that's really interesting. So it's really like if you can get them a little taste of that experience, then maybe their future advocating on their own behalf sort of takes care of itself, it sounds like.
I think that's absolutely what happens. You know, I'll never forget my first experience was a little bit atypical. I was invited to speak at a rally on Capitol Hill, and you know, I was on the Hill there and on stage with Dana Reeve and Tom Harkin and Hillary Clinton and Lindsey Graham. And then afterwards, we went into the congressional offices and buildings to meet with our representatives. And I was just completely, absolutely overwhelmed and intoxicated by, you know, the ability and the hope to create change. And I'll never forget that day because it was the kind of the birth of my advocacy journey. You know, the next week, it was easier to pick up the phone and make a phone call to my elected representative or send that email or to, you know, to sign up for another advocacy event. I truly think, you know, taking that first step is where this all begins and the hardest part. And once you cross that barrier, once you cross that threshold, you know, people become advocates for life because it is incredibly empowering to feel as if you're doing all that you can to create change for our community.
Okay, so I have two more questions. So I'd like to sort of look into the future. 2020 was a year in which a lot of us had to take a hard look at issues of social justice and inequality, and I saw a lot of social media posts in which people with disabilities shared their experiences of being marginalized and excluded and dismissed, and the way they talked had an absolute similarity to what some African Americans and other people of color were saying that they experienced. Plus, of course, as you mentioned, the pandemic made us all more isolated, and that's something that people with disabilities have to, unfortunately, deal with at a much higher rate than people who don't have disabilities. So I know that you have a daughter, a young daughter. How do you think we raise this generation of children, your daughter, her peers? How do we raise this next generation to be more compassionate and inclusive of everyone, including people with disabilities?
That's the million-dollar question, and it's something that I ask myself every day of the week before she wakes up and begins her day. Yeah, you know, I have to remind myself sometimes that no one enters this world as racist or sexist or homophobic or ableist or with any other negative view. You know, those views arise as the product of their environment and the environment in which they were cultured. And I think as cheesy as it sounds, the responsibility kind of lies within ourselves, the adults in the room, the parents of these children, or the people that interact with these children, to make the necessary changes, you know, needed to create an inclusive environment for everyone. You know, an environment that acknowledges our differences, but looks for and celebrates the common bonds that tie us all together. And I say acknowledges our differences because, you know, I think it's easy sometimes for people to say, oh, I don't see color or I don't see disability. Well, you know what? A lot of people identify with color or disability or the things that do make them different. And I think it's important to acknowledge those differences, but still do everything we can to seek to find those common bonds. And, you know, I think right now the division in our country, I struggle to even how to say this, but it's absolutely heartbreaking. And the recent events in our Capitol, you know, they've been incredibly difficult to watch. They've served as a reminder for all of, you know, all of the things that we must really do everything we can to overcome and prevent from being passed down to the next generation. But, you know, that said, when I see my daughter interacting with her friends and they're from all backgrounds and cultures, which I absolutely love, you know, I'm hopeful that each generation will be more tolerant than the last and that eventually those toxic views will pass over time and be replaced by what I see on our playground. And as far as people with disabilities are concerned, I think the best thing we can do is be present in all aspects of society. You know, I've said it before and I'll say it again. People with disabilities, we're our country's family members, coworkers, friends, and emerging leaders. You know, we need to be present in every aspect of society to help create change. And life with a disability is hard. And for me personally, there are absolutely days where my spinal cord injury does everything it possibly can to defeat me. You know, with that in mind, I think those of us with disabilities have to keep on keeping on in order to remain part of the conversation and a visible, influential portion of society. You know, people with disabilities are making a difference and changing perceptions each and every day just by waking up and moving forward. But, you know, if we really want to create change, you know, I'd ask them to join us in the disability advocacy movement.
Okay, and now I'm down to my last question. So I'm going to spend it, I think, hopefully talking about, I think, one of your favorite subjects, and that's your daughter. She is 7 right now, I believe. How do you explain your disabilities, other people's disabilities, and assistive technology to her. I was wondering if she's had friends or classmates ask you about your wheelchair or talk to her about, you know, what does your dad have there? What is that he's sitting on? And if so, how do you answer them? Because they're still young, I know, and hopefully they do have a sense of curiosity about it. So I wanted to know sort of how you handle those conversations with her classmates if you're doing a school activity and they come up to you and talk about it. And I also wanted to ask what the best part of being her dad is.
Oh, you're absolutely correct. It is 100% my favorite topic of discussion. And I've said before, anybody who speaks to me for more than a couple of minutes is going to hear about my daughter. So thank you for asking. But, you know, she was born in 2013, which is 10 years after my injury. I was injured in August of 2003. And the only dad she has ever known has been one who uses a wheelchair. And she's also well aware of kind of what I do for a living and the people that we serve. And one of the things I'm so proud of her about her, and there are a ton of things, is what I refer to as her emotional intelligence. And I imagine there's probably a more appropriate technical term for it, but she is incredibly aware of the emotions and feelings of others, and she always has been. Love that about her. Now, I'd like to think that some of that is the result of her awareness of the challenges faced by the disability community, since she sees some of them firsthand at home every day of the week. But, you know, I've also gone out of my way to make sure that she's been taught to be respectful and inclusive of everyone. And fortunately, her school also does an amazing job in this arena. And I'm currently working with both, you know, the Parents Association and faculty at her school right now on accessibility and disability awareness projects that were initiated by her school. I didn't even have to talk to them about this proactively. They initiated the conversations and asked me to be a part of that. So, you know, I'm fortunate that she goes to such an inclusive and progressive school. But, you know, since I am such an active part of her school environment, I'm visible. And kids, of course, they ask questions about, you know, my disability. Most of the time, you know, before I can even open my mouth to respond, you know, Reese, my daughter, lets them know that I have a spinal cord injury and that I use a wheelchair to get around. And she absolutely beams when she tells them that. Like, she's not ashamed at all. And, of course, she shouldn't be. But it warms my heart to see the pride pour out of her little heart when she tells people that, you know, her dad's job is to help people with disabilities. You know, honestly, I'm getting a little misty-eyed right now just thinking about her saying that. But I've heard her say that, you know, 10, 12, 15 times. It's just amazing to hear. And now the cool thing is, to most of all the kids at her school, I'm just Reese's dad. I'm not the guy in a wheelchair. I'm just Reese's dad. And you know, quite honestly, I wouldn't have it any other way. As far as I'm concerned, mission accomplished. You know, that's the way I'd like for them to see me. It's just Reese's dad, not some guy with a disability or some guy with a wheelchair. Just Reese's dad being Reese's dad. You know, it's funny how I think about all of us with visible disabilities. I think most all of us have stories about, you know, kids asking their parents questions in public. A lot of times this happens in the grocery store for some reason, but, you know, like, mommy, daddy, like, why is he using a wheelchair? And then the parents will kind of shh them away or kind of quickly sweep them away and treat it as something to be avoided. You know, and I personally think that is the absolute wrong approach. And whenever the opportunity presents itself and it's appropriate to respond, you know, of course, with the parents' consent, I let the kid know why I use a chair and how it helps me live my life. And we have to mainstream disability. We can't just sweep it under a rug and expect anything to change. And when we shush kids away from learning about or talking about disability, you know, it's not advancing the causes of the people with disability. It's making it something that should be swept under the rug and something that should be, you know, not discussed and something that we shouldn't think about. And again, I think that's the wrong way to approach things. But as for the best part of being your dad, you know, I think it's the same as it is for a lot of people that don't have disabilities. It's watching those light bulbs light up in her head as she learns something new, especially over the past year. She's kind of learned from home, even though she's back on campus now. But kind of watching her learn last year as I tried to work was amazing. But it's also the compassion that she has in her heart for others. And as a single dad with a disability, you know, she and I made an agreement to approach things as a team. You know, we promise each other, you know, always, I'll give you my best and you'll always try to give me your best too. And that way, even on difficult disability days, she's aware of the fact that I'm doing absolutely everything I can to make sure she's happy and healthy and safe. She knows it, and I truly believe she appreciates it. And I'm just so very proud to be her dad. It is absolutely the most important and best part of my life. And I'd like to think that the work I do with New Motion and the foundation is making the world a better place. And that's for me, and that's for her, and that's for her friends and her classmates and the next generation.
I'm just picturing Reese right now, like during a school drop-off or something. I'm just picturing a new kid maybe running up and saying, "What's that? What's your dad have? How come there's wheels there?" And I can just picture Reese looking at you and saying, "Dad, I got this one. Let me explain to you what spinal cord injury is." I mean, that's amazing that she does that and that she's so proud to share, like, this is why my dad has more great stuff going on than your dad has. Let me tell you about his wheels.
You know, it's so funny. She does. That's the way she handles it. And, you know, I truly hope it'll always be that way, but that's definitely the way it is now. And I love it. And it makes me just so proud of her. And I love the fact, obviously, that she's proud of her dad. But, you know, I also think, you know, being the child of someone with a disability, it opens you up to a worldview that, you know, you otherwise would not have exposure to. And, you know, I think the views that the children and people with disabilities have are truly going to help make the world a better place. It's going to spread positivity. It's going to spread inclusion. It's going to spread love, and not just for people with disabilities. I think it opens children's eyes to all sorts of differences and things that they may not have been exposed to before. And really, who could argue against that? I mean, we all need to seek to be better and to love more and to, you know, to be less divisive. And if I can help her learn those things through the prism of disability, then, you know, I'm doing my job.
Well, that's awesome. Thanks so much, Justin. I really appreciate your time and that perspective. It's heartening to hear that maybe the next generation will approach assistive technology as just something that's very normal, and people with disabilities will be viewed more as people first. And so wonderful to hear about those interactions with your daughter. And with that, we'll be wrapping up our podcast with Justin Richardson from New Motion. Justin, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Mobility Management podcasts are available for listening and downloading on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. The best way to make sure you don't miss any of our podcasts is to subscribe. So you can also go onto our website at mobilitymgmt.com to listen there. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks to Justin again, and we'll be back again soon.